We have just passed summer solstice, you may have noticed. Summer solstice was Friday. And yesterday, you might not know, yesterday was the date of midsummer. And in the same way that Christmas lags a little bit behind winter solstice, a few days, midsummer lags in Celtic calendars in the northern European countries a few days after summer solstice. So a couple of weeks ago, I was reading a novel about the Hebrides, the Scottish Islands, and one of the things that they happened to mention was that on Midsummer night, well, we often in this country, at least my association with summer solstice, we think that's the beginning of summer, but in the Celtic countries, it's considered midsummer. That's why it's called Midsummer's Eve or Midsummer Night's Eve. And on Midsummer Night's Eve in the Scottish Hebrides, in the islands, they light bonfires on the highest points of all the islands so that at midnight, they do this at midnight, the night before midsummer, so you can see from one island to the next, but looking at these bonfires at night. It's a very ancient practice. Nobody knows quite where it originated, but there are tales that the fires were meant to scare off evil spirits and dragons. Dragons were thought to fly at midsummer. But it's a very ancient practice, and to the best of my knowledge, most cultures that I've ever studied or read about, most religions recognize these seasonal changes, the solstices. If not the more recent or the more frequent changes like the full moons, new moons. I've given talks before about winter solstice. And winter solstice has always been kind of an easy holiday, celebration to talk about, especially in a Buddhist context because it's the dark days of the year and it's a time for going inward. It's a time for meditation retreats. It's a time for not doing a whole lot because the weather's inclement in many parts of the world. It's a time for going inward in meditation. It's a very kind of Buddhist feeling holiday. But what about summer solstice? Should we not like it because it's middle of summer? No, most of us love this time of year. The days are long. Most of us have a preference for light over dark. I certainly do. I have had at various times in my life a tendency to have some seasonal affective disorder in the wintertime. If I don't get enough light, I get a little cranky long before I even get depressed. If it ever gets to the point of getting depressed, I just get kind of out of sorts when I don't get enough light. So I'm really sensitive to the dark. But the light's great. I have a preference for it. So why don't we hear talks about summer solstice so much? The Buddha, one of his teachings that he repeated over and over again is that it's not so skillful to have preferences. If we like things one way and not the other way, then we're always going to be in a state of dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction being one of the definitions, one of the words we use for dukkha, the first noble truth. But if we can let go of our preferences and simply notice the changing seasons, noticing these points of the year, summer solstice, winter solstice, full moons, half moons, that have always been recognized by our ancestors because we used to be agricultural people and these things were important, what we notice is change. The summer solstice is simply a momentary point in the great clock or the great tipping of the earth as it spins through space. As soon as it arrives, it passes. The sun aligns with the stones of Stonehenge at one specific point, but only for a few moments. Everybody shows up on that morning to watch the sun pass through the stones, but I think the way our ancestors might have looked at it is not so much this point is important, this point in time, as It's passing time. It's a recognition of change, a recognition of impermanence of the seasons that's being celebrated by the solstices. The continuum of seasonal change. It's both predictable and ever-changing. In Buddhist monasteries, these points in time, the solstices, the full moons, the new moons, are celebrated as Upasatha days. That's a Pali word, Upasatha days, like Sabbath. So essentially, every week, full moon, new moon, half moon, quarter moons, every week, there's an Upasatha day based on the phases of the moon when the monks stay up, or nuns stay up all night and meditate. The recognizing change of the seasons. The changing seasons, like the changing seasons of our lives, our own personal lives, can be celebrated or feared. The Buddha advocated simply acknowledging that the only reliable refuge is the present moment amidst all this change. The only reliable refuge is here and now. The Buddha talked about three fundamental characteristics of existence, of all conditioned phenomena, whether it's mental or physical, whether it's your own mind or Mount Everest, share three essential characteristics. In Pali, the words are anicca, anatta, and dukkha. In English, impermanence, the illusory nature of the self, and unreliability. Dukkha is one of those characteristics. Dukkha is also the First Noble Truth, the Buddha's most fundamental teaching. Often, in fact, usually, mistranslated as suffering. I just sat a retreat with a Buddhist monk named Analio, who some of you may be familiar with his Satipatthana book, but he's a famous translator, one of the leading translators of Buddhist texts in the world. And he's just adamant about this. And I really agree with him. He convinced me that he said, please don't call dukkha suffering. Dukkha is unreliability, better translated as unreliability, sometimes dissatisfaction. But in the context of the other characteristics of existence that the Buddha talked about, impermanence and the illusory nature of self, unreliability is understandable. The world is unreliable because it's impermanent, right? If everything's changing, including our mind, including our body, if everything's changing, then by nature, it's unreliable. So the First Noble Truth is unreliability. Life is unreliable. Our common response to unreliability is dissatisfaction or stress. Our response is stress. Our response might be suffering. It might be okay to say that our response to unreliability is suffering. But that's because we don't like change. We don't like impermanence. When we get something the way we like it, our relationship, our family, our job, our health, we want it to stay that way, don't we? A reactive response to unreliability, the stress that it produces, is because of craving and clinging. This is the second noble truth that the Buddha taught. The cause of suffering is craving and clinging. Is we want things to stay the way they are. We don't want things to change. Even things that it's their nature to change, we don't want them to change. So we create stress in our lives. This is the fundamental problem. Trying to fix things in time, to impede the process of change, to control our reality. We become control freaks of our lives. It takes a lot of energy, stressful. This is the origin of suffering. all experiencing change all the time in our lives, in our meditation, if you played with that in your meditation, in our daily lives, leads to stress and anxiety. Or it can lead to letting go and accepting the changing nature of phenomena. This is the third noble truth that the Buddha taught. Freedom from suffering. The third noble truth is the antidote for stress and the secret of happiness. Letting go and accepting change at the deepest level. So if we resist change, the inevitable change that is a characteristic of existence, if we fight it, we'll have stress, we'll have suffering. If we accept change, at least that which we're able to accept, we find some freedom, happiness. There's a daily chant that nuns and monks do every single day in monasteries, and it's also the same chant that they do, they offer at funerals. The first line in Pali, some of you might recognize, it's a famous chant. I'll just mention the first line in Pali is Anicca Vata Sankara. And in English, the chant is, all conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. All conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. So as the Buddha taught, and as monks and nuns practice every single day, constantly reminding themselves that it's the nature of things to be impermanent. To live in harmony with that impermanence brings the highest happiness. The Buddha's last words, pretty close to his last words, his last teaching, were, all things are impermanent. With mindfulness, strive on. That was it. That's how the Buddha checked out. All things are impermanent. With mindfulness, strive on. Understanding the nature of change and the changing nature, like solstices, and integrating change allows us to not only accept but appreciate our own impermanence. Ajahn Chah, the great Thai meditation master of the mid-20th century, said this, our lives are like the breath, like the growing and falling leaves. When we can really understand about falling leaves, we can sweep the paths every day and have the great happiness in our lives on this changing earth. So, in the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, particularly the Satipatthana Sutta, or Four Foundations of Mindfulness, where the Buddha taught us what to pay attention to, what to be mindful of, the first foundation of mindfulness is the body. And that's why I mentioned it several times during the course of our meditation. If you're going to be mindful of nothing else in your experience, be mindful of the body. It's the first foundation, it's the foundational practice. Buddhist teacher Reggie Ray says, when the body calls us back, like when our mind has gone off into la-la land and our body calls us back, we begin to find that we have a partner on the spiritual path that we didn't know about, the body itself. In our meditation and in our surrounding lives, the body becomes a teacher. So bringing home this ever-present lesson of impermanence, it shows itself in the seasons of the year, it shows itself in the earth spinning on its axis, passing through the solar system, and it shows itself in our very own bodies. In a very famous sutta about this, about the body, the human body, and the as a container of wisdom, this is what the Buddha said. I tell you, friend, that it is not possible by traveling to know or see or reach a far end of the cosmos where one does not take birth, age, die, pass away, or reappear. But at the same time, I tell you that there is no making an end of suffering and stress without reaching the end of the cosmos. Yet, it is just within this fathom-long body, with its perception and intellect, that I declare that there is the cosmos, the origin of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of the cosmos. So the Buddha is saying that the cosmic totality of our experience of the universe all happens in your body. When the Buddha talks about, sometimes in this translation, the translator uses the word cosmos, sometimes it's world. The Buddha talks about the end of the world, the beginning of the world. The world, for the Buddha, is something that each one of us creates by ourselves. There's no objective world out there that's not separate from you. Everything's connected, and it starts in your own body. In fact, it's completely contained by your own body. The world or cosmos being our fabricated sense of self. So reflecting on the tilt of the axis of the Earth's axis as it spins through the cosmos, and being mindful of each and every breath are really the same activity. Noticing and accepting the nature of change. Change feels unreliable, dukkha. Change feels like dukkha until we can fully accept it. Then, like the solstice, it becomes reliable. That which we perceived as unreliable becomes reliable. We can pretty much predict, count on the solstice, even though it's part of change. When we let go of resisting change, we lose our fear of old age, illness, and death. This might be hard to conceive of. It might be hard to imagine having no fear of old age, illness, and death. But many Buddhist masters have shown it to be true. Here's a quote that's kind of heavy duty, but it's a powerful statement of this phenomena from Jeff Foster. You will lose everything, your money, your power, your fame, your success, perhaps even your memories. Your looks will go. Loved ones will die. Your body will fall apart. Everything that seems permanent is impermanent and will be smashed. Experience will gradually, or not so gradually, strip away everything that it can strip away. Waking up means facing this reality with open eyes and no longer turning away. But right now, we stand on sacred and holy ground. For that which will be lost has not yet been lost. In realizing this is the key to unspeakable joy. Whoever or whatever is in your life right now has not yet been taken away from you. This may sound trivial, obvious, like nothing, but really it is the key to everything. The why and the how and the wherefore of existence. Impermanence has already rendered everything, everyone around you so deeply holy and significant and worthy of your heartbreaking gratitude. Loss has already transfigured your life into an altar. So this is the practice that brings freedom from suffering that the Buddha promised and leads to happiness. This is how Murray Oliver puts it. Fragment from a poem. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, And when the time comes to let it go, let it go. In Zen, the Zen tradition, many Zendos have a what's called a han. Instead of a bell, usually, there's a big block of wood that they hit with a hammer to call monastics to meditation, this block of wood, different kind of sound. And it's traditional to have this carved on the, this phrase carved on the han. Also, it's sometimes chanted before bedtime in the monasteries. It's an exhortation to practice, and it paraphrases the final words of the Buddha that I read earlier on. And the phrase that's carved into the han is this: may I respectfully remind you, great is the matter of birth and death. All is impermanent, quickly passing. Be awake each moment. Don't waste this life. So, that's what I have to offer on impermanence. I started out being inspired by those fires on Scottish mountains, and I came back to the breath, which is often where we end up in Buddhist practice. It's all the same thing. So thank you for your kind attention, and we have a few minutes if anyone has a comment or question or something to add. Please.
Will you tell us the book you read?
Sorry?
Will you tell us the book you read?
The book I read.
Oh,
it was, well, that's embarrassing. It was a book out of a detective series by Anne Cleave. And I can't remember if it's the same series that there was a TV series called Shetland.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that, I can't remember if that's her books or another. There's also a guy that writes mysteries about. I like to read books that are set in bleak and far off places, you know, Wuthering Heights. Yeah, but it was Anne Cleave is the author, and she wrote a series of detective novels about the Shetland Islands. Yeah. Anyone else thoughts about just talking about impermanence, about push buttons, or? Please.
I'm grateful for what you said about unreliable living.
Yep. Hi, Howie. Thanks, Howie.
Yep, I can hear you.
I'm very grateful for what you said about unreliability becoming reliable, the way that, you know, I felt like that was really a point at which I really got what you were saying, and I also feel like the fact that unreliability is so much part of the way things are is something I'm sort of struggling with. And do you have any more insight into the nature of, I guess, the nature of reliability? I know that it seems to me like what the teaching is saying is it's all unreliable, but in that we can find rhythm somewhere. And the solstice is a representation. Are there other insights that you have about that?
Well, I think what these teachers are getting at, starting with the Buddha, is that if we, impermanence only feels unreliable if you're fighting it, if you're resistant to it. If we can come to accept impermanence, then what seemed to be unreliable becomes reliable, including this body, getting old, aging, getting ill and dying. It's things that really bother most of us. We, you know, it's the reason the Buddhists called old age, illness, and death the heavenly messengers is because these are our teachers that often bring us to Dharma practice. It's what causes so much suffering in our lives. But imagine for a moment, and I'm not there, but I can imagine it. Imagine for a moment that if you can truly accept the fact that you're going to become old, get ill, and eventually die, you're probably going to have an easier time of that whole process than if you're struggling the entire time. This has been a really core, fundamental practice in my own life because I was diagnosed with AIDS more than 30 years ago. I was diagnosed with AIDS almost before it had a name, and there was only one drug at the time. And I was told that I only had 6 months to live at the most. I was guaranteed that I was going to die. And my doctors pretty much repeat that for the past 30 years. Like, oh, you're not going to live very long. I'm so grateful that I had my Buddhist practice, and it's been a guiding practice for me for my entire life, because as much as I am able to simply reside in the present moment, you know, I have this life-threatening disease that has been a scary umbrella over my head for 30 years, but right in this moment, if I just pay attention to my five senses and my mind, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong in this moment. So we're all getting older. We all may have, you may have issues that are different than mine. But if you think about it, just using your five senses and your consciousness right in this moment, what exactly is wrong? Most of what we create as being wrong is fear of the future or regret about the past. So this wonderful practice that the Buddha taught us about simply bringing ourselves back to the moment, as we did in the meditation this morning. Your mind wanders away, gets caught up in thought, gets caught up in fears. Bring your attention back to your moment. Start with your breath. Start all over again. Ground yourself in the moment. We get good at it. And there's peace in that. There's peace in the present moment. Does that help?
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
It's not easy. That's why the Buddha said this practice is going against the stream. Our culture doesn't encourage us to face old age, illness, and death. Again, getting back to our agricultural ancestors, children grew up with mom having babies in the next room and grandma dying in the next room and the changes of the seasons. And that was all quite natural to the human family until really the last couple of generations. We've become separated from the reality of change. Any other thoughts or reflections? Fears? Well, let's all just settle and offer the merit of our practice. Thank you for your kind attention and your comments, and thanks for sticking it out with me. Just sending out some gratitude that we have this practice to support us, no matter what's going on in our lives, no matter what chains are happening. We have this precious gift from the Buddha, who told us how to remain in the present moment, how to do this practice. Because in the same way that we want to be happy, that we want to be free of suffering, that we want our lives to be grounded in peace and ease, we wish that for our loved ones. And moving beyond our loved ones, all beings, everyone we come in contact with, everyone that we'll never come in contact with. It's our deepest wish that all beings be safe from danger and harm, be healthy in body and mind, that they may live with peace and ease and be free of suffering.